Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Let's get back to real life now. I'm delighted to welcome back to the show now the gaffer herself, clinical psychologist Maureen Gaffney. Good afternoon. It's been too long.
Good afternoon, Brendan. How are you?
Good, thanks. And we are going to talk about friendship today, which is a simple word, but a complicated beast, really, I think. And people can text questions if they want on friendship to 51551, or you can WhatsApp 087-032-3232. And sure, we'll deal with them as best we can. But anyway, Maureen, you say there are four different types of friends, and people might see themselves or their friends in one of these. So what are the four types of friends?
In a very general way, yeah. I would say that there are people that you might call carers. They are people who are very sensitive to what's going on in people's lives, you know, and they're always ready to offer support or practical help, but they don't do it in an intrusive way. They're very often actually underestimated as friends because they're often quiet and they don't draw attention to themselves. The other kind of friend is the one we all want to be, the one I call like angels, right? They're caring, they organize things, you know, they know a lot, they give you opportunities, they support you, they do everything,
yeah,
you know,
and
we all hit that occasionally, I think. And then there are the ones that are more troublesome friends. There's the narcissists, the people who are very, very self-preoccupied. You know, in every conversation, they bring it back to what interests them. They lose interest and make very little attempt to disguise it when you're saying something. And I think they are they're kind of difficult people, but
they can be great fun too.
They can be great fun for a time, but
yeah.
But you find that you're sort of tense with them, you know, because you're always aware that they can just take off, and then, you know, they dig themselves into such a hole, and we all fall into it, and the conversation falls into it.
Okay.
And then there are the manipulators. They're the really difficult people because they're very into power, but they try to disguise it. So they're kind of strategic, you know. They'll flatter you if they want you to do something. They'll support you because they're already thinking, I'm just going to need something much bigger off you soon. And I think they're hard to deal with because they often disguise it. You know, they disguise that sort of power thing under this vulnerable front. So it's sort of poor me, you know, I've had such a hard life and, you know, I've so many things that I have to deal with. And then they come in just as you're sort of open to them. Maybe they're not so bad. Then they come in for the kill. So I think they're difficult people. But no matter how difficult friends are, unless they're really now toxic, friends are hugely important.
You know, when all this. So is it best not to be, just before we move away from those four types, so is it best then not to be too fussy maybe about the manipulators and the narcissists, as you say, unless they're completely toxic? Should we be fairly accepting of that people in our circle, that everyone's not perfect and everybody has their own little...
Well, certainly none of us is perfect. I think it's more in a group situation, you know, and friends socialize in a group, you know, you have your one-to-one relationships and you have much more control about them. So if that person just really gets on your nerves and you come back sort of irritated from an interaction, you can decide yourself, I'm going to see them much less or I'm not going to see them at all. I think the issue is more troublesome, though, when people like that are in a social group, you know, because, you know, we do go out as a group of people together. You know, we go to the cinema or go to the theatre or go out for dinner or, you know, that kind of thing.
And that's very, it's very good for us groups.
It's very good, but it's much more difficult to manage people like that in a group. So if, for example, someone ignores you or is sort of unappreciative of what you say, dismisses what you say, it's witnessed by other people in the group. And if you don't get support, you feel it very keenly. So it sort of affects your relationship with the other people in the group. You know, you just come away and you think like, that was an awful evening I didn't enjoy it. But the group thing makes it more complicated. You may just have to find a way of dealing with it.
What's the best way to deal with it?
Well, like, I think
minimize it.
What you're trying to do in a group situation, say you're out for dinner or something, what you're trying to do is you're trying to not let your attention and therefore your irritation be, as it were, inflamed. So I think it's useful to try and get out of eye contact with them. So maybe sit on the side they're sitting so that you can sort of interact and catch other people's eyes rather than, you know, be there facing them yourself, you know, in a cauldron of irritation. So
Good. I like it. Very simple one. Tell me about the two dimensions in groups, closeness and status.
And status. These are kind of hardwired drives that, you know, when we come into the world, we have to have people around us that we're close to who will support us and protect us and so on. But we also, very early on, have to establish our position in life. And those drives are with us all of the time. They're very acute in adolescence. You know, you're very preoccupied by your peer group as an adolescent. And you're also very preoccupied by your position. These things are all, these two needs are also become very much at the forefront of your mind when you're in a transition, you know, like you're going to college, you know, or you're starting a new job, or you're moving to a new area. You're kind of starting from scratch and you have to reestablish new ways of being close to people and new ways of, as it were, finding a position for yourself in the group. So I think that you're never that far away from those two needs. And we monitor them all the time. I think women have slightly, they're more attuned to the closeness thing. Women can measure every millimetre of closeness. They're very adept at spotting a diminution. So that women are, you very rarely hear a man talking about someone being cool to them, you know. But women come back and they say, you know, she was very cool to me, you know, because they can pick up that there's some distancing going on, some lack of appreciation. And men, I suppose, are slightly more attuned to status. Men don't like being intruded on, you know. So it's not that they're territorial in any sort of extreme way, but they don't like being intruded on. They like to, as it were, pace themselves so that if you watch two men or two boys interacting, they may say, you know, how are things going in a general way? And, you know, they'll chat. But say if they know something is going on in the other guy's life, they wait for a cue to ask more about it because they don't want to overstep the mark. I think the same, I think, in a group, that the boys are extremely conscious of where they are in a hierarchy in a group. And I think men are as well.
Okay.
Not in any, you know, sort of I'm top dog, but they have a very acute sense of where they are. They're very happy for someone to lead the way, you know, but the role has to be earned. Like every position you have in a group, any bit of advancement you have has to be earned. And until you do that, you stay in lane. I think boys and men are much more attuned to that end of things.
So you see, listening to that, you think, no, Jesus, it's the social thing is incredibly complex, and some people know these things intrinsically and know how to play
by
them,
instinct,
right?
And
other people then find it harder to get that.
Yeah.
But I suppose the one thing you would say about it is that it is very good for us to be doing all this stuff.
It is. I mean, Jean-Paul Sartre, you know, famously said, you know, the philosopher, you know, hell is other people, you know. And certainly, you know, there are days when you think like, you know, you said it, you know. But overall and generally speaking, even though particular interactions may irritate the life out of you or upset you, the overall having friends in your life is really, really important.
Specifically.
It's important for everything. You learn about yourself because friends give you feedback. You learn about other people. You are much happier on a day when you have social activity. You feel much more positive than you do on a day when you don't. Friends encourage you to try things. See, I have a friend who has got me to try things that I never, ever thought I would. And I'm very grateful to it. They kind of put you outside your comfort zone, which I think is a good thing. And I think like that it also keeps your brain active. It's actually quite hard work, you know, monitoring and everything that's going on in an interaction or a friendship. But it's really worthwhile, and it does keep your brain very active and it improves your cognitive functioning. And that's particularly important later in life, you know, when your friendship circle becomes really important, you know, because there are so few left. But friends add a dimension that is really because...
So we really only become our full potential in relation to other people.
And of course,
people.
How else are you going to learn about building trust in a relationship, you know, apart from your family and all of that? But you learn a whole set of other skills about building trust in a social relationship, in a friendship. And of course, friends give you that sense of belonging, that you have a little group, a little tribe, a little cohort of people who are going to go through the life cycle with you.
Okay. And that brings us to, I have some questions here. Some of them are quite specific, but they're interesting. But I just want to ask you one other thing about... I suppose we've been talking about the kind of maybe our broader circle there.
Yeah.
You say there's an inner circle and an outer circle, and they're probably a bit different. We've maybe talked about the outer circle more, the broader. Tell me about the inner circle
the inner
and the
circle,
importance of that.
Are really your closest friends, the people you feel closest to. And these are people that you rely on. You know that when you're up or when you're down, they're going to be there for you. They're going to support you and keep you going when you're going through a rough patch. But also, if things go right for you, they genuinely celebrate it. They're happy for you.
That's a mark of a real friend, isn't it? Yeah. And you can spot that too.
Someone
who's actually happy for you.
Even
someone who's saying all the right things, but you can tell they're not.
We are hypersensitive to that. And we're particularly hypersensitive to any lack of authenticity or sincerity. We have a little part of our brain specifically devoted to that. So we pick up very fast if someone is not being themselves or are pretending, you know, to support you when they really don't, or to be happy for you when they really aren't.
And it's probably important for us as well to have those people that you can be 100% yourself with as well, that there doesn't need to be any filter there.
And the second thing is that you feel you can confide in them, that you can talk about very private matters, and that is not going to go beyond them. Because if that happens, your trust is broken in someone.
Okay.
You know, if someone, you tell them something that is private and maybe a bit sensitive, and then you hear it back from another friend, then, you know, they move right down the hierarchy then, as far as you're concerned.
That circle of trust is extremely important.
Yeah, it is. And the other thing is that to maintain that intimacy in a relationship, you have to see people fairly frequently.
Okay.
You know, you can still maintain, you know, a friend who's moved abroad. You can maintain an intimate relationship in the sense that you meet them after a year and it's like you can carry on the conversation you last had. But there's a limit to that. So I think those three things, that you can rely on them, that you see them often, and that you can trust them, that you can confide in them, really are the markers of a really good friendship.
OK, how many of those kind of people do you want to have in your life? Could it be quite a small group?
It varies a lot. I would say 8+, maybe. You know, maybe 8 to 10 people. But they would be people that you would generally trust, and you would confide a lot in.
Yeah.
But then there's the bestie.
There's the core within that. Okay.
The best friend or the second best friend, you know, which isn't always reciprocated, but is like in your mind, they're your best friend.
Okay, grand. Just don't ask them for an expression of it. Like, don't just have it going on in your own head. Okay. You know, there's an interesting thing going on here, that friends can actually let each other down in a way that nobody else can let people down. There's a thread here of people feeling let down, and in a particular way as well. I have a friend who annoys me intensely. I've had cancer in the past. I don't talk about it, but occasionally it's referenced. And this friend makes her contribution to the chat and finishes off with, "Oh, I'm so lucky as I have great health," right? And there's another one here as well. "When my beautiful brother was diagnosed with lung cancer, I was devastated. But when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, had a mastectomy last year, didn't contact me. I met her in town, acknowledged a bad friend, listed everything I had done, but then didn't even condole with me when my beloved brother died." So that, do you know that situation that arises where someone feels they really supported another person in a thing, and then their time comes and
there's
feel
a huge
support.
Sense of betrayal, I think, when that happens. And I think that stays with people. It takes a long, long time to rebuild, if ever, the trust you had in them originally. But I would say, though, that sometimes it's not because people don't care. It's that there's so much else going on in their own life that they underestimate how long a grief lasts, you know, or an upset. You know, they're very supportive maybe for the first couple of weeks. And then, you know, they're back into their own lives, and they often are shocked to discover that that maybe 2-3 months on, somebody is still wrestling with the whatever it is that upset them, you know. And I think we all fall into that trap. You know, we underestimate because we haven't had that experience ourselves. We underestimate, you know, how long the grief can last.
Do you think before we have a falling out with anybody, or before we decide that person is dead to me now, you know, we can get quite high-handed in moments about people.
Yeah.
Should we try and talk to them first? Because often we probably don't hash it out.
Yeah. Well, I think if this is somebody that you value as a friend, or you thought was a friend, I think you owe it to them to say to them, I'm just astonished, really, and I'm very hurt at the way you've reacted to what's happened to me. And that at least gives them the opportunity to to say, well, yeah, you know, it was pretty terrible and I felt very let down by you. And you have to tolerate that they may be angry for a while and not immediately jump to your own defence. So you have to endure a little bit of pain.
Okay, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And then I think if people are reasonable, you know, and of course you have to say sorry. I mean, you have to say sorry seven times, you know, so that people know that you actually are sorry.
And okay, but when you so when you're coming something. With your grievance and your attack, you might find that actually you might hear a few things you don't like, that you weren't so perfect either.
Well, that's right.
All good
yeah.
to have it all later.
And you need time to process as well, you know, because, you know, we are naturally sort of defensive about if we think we're good people, we're very defensive if someone says, well, you know, you didn't act like a good person. So you have to allow people some time, you know, to process the feedback that you're giving.
Yeah.
Them.
Yeah.
But then it's up to you, the person who let someone down inadvertently or whatever. It's up to you then to make the next move, you know, to offer to meet them again, you know, offer to help them about something. And I think you can. You can work your way back into trust, but not always. You know, sometimes, you know, you learn a very hard lesson, you know, and hopefully you won't repeat that mistake again.
There are a lot of people asking questions about how to make friends in adulthood,
yeah.
starting a new job, an autistic person who has no jobs, older person whose friends have all passed away, that kind of thing. It's hard, isn't it?
It's very, very difficult. And I near where I live, there's you know, when I'm walking into town, there's a big billboard, you know, for advertising some drop-in centre. I think they are fantastic facilities.
A lot of people are going to be too proud to go into
but
a situation like that.
But I think that's why you have to offer things that people can use as a cover, you know.
I like it.
Know, you can say, you know, we've a really, really good community board, you know, that will tell you what's going on, you know, neighbourhood watch, all of that kind of stuff. You can say to people, you know, you can sort of target people, you know, like, say, who are just retired, who often, you know, feel a bit sort of cut off from the friends they used to have, or somebody new to an area. You can say, if you're new to an area, if you're new to this area, or if you have now more time because you're retired, or, you know, you can find ways of targeting.
Okay.
You know, we really, really need people like you to help others. And I think that gives people a feeling that they're choosing to come in to help others. And of course, there is nothing that is better to cure loneliness and cure, as it were, your own grief, or at least lessen it, than helping somebody else. Because you help them, but you're also helping yourself.
Okay. A few people asking here, like, one person, should you be friends with your sibling, or is it okay if your siblings, is it okay if you're not? Someone else, is it possible to be friends with your siblings without judging or competing with each other, especially as everyone gets older and forms new families themselves? Yeah. The sibling friendship is a whole different beast, really, isn't it?
This is kind of tricky, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that because someone is your sibling doesn't mean that you know, you get on very well with them. We all know that from childhood. You know, there are some people in your family that, you know, you'll stick up for them in a fight, maybe, you know. But like, they annoy you, you know. There's something about them that just, you know, sort of rubs up against you. And sometimes it's rivalry in the family, and of course the worst, favoritism. If somebody is favored, you know, by a parent, you are doing them no favors, really, because it antagonizes siblings who feel like, you know, oh, you're the one who always gets everything. So I don't think you can expect siblings to be friends. It's great if they are. You know, I know families, particularly families of, say, a lot of girls in the family, and they're as thick as thieves. You know, they see each other, they talk to each other, etc. I think it's a bit more difficult for men because when men marry, they, as it were, you know, the emphasis moves to the wife's family. You know, that, you know, it's all kept very even, you know, like Christmas, you know, like for the first couple of years. But there's a tilt, you know, towards the, particularly once you have children, towards the wife's family. And so men can lose sort of contact with their siblings, you know. So all kinds of things can get in the way.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily have to be friends.
I suppose the best thing about your siblings is that you have all this history together and they know you like and nobody else does. And the worst thing about your siblings is you've all this history together and they know you like anyone else.
Precisely.
So I just want to ask you one more thing. And this is about, I suppose, like it's been underlying all the time here. But the idea that we have to work at friendships. A lot of people talking about, like, friends don't want to talk on the phone anymore. It's all text now and people don't see each other anymore. And someone else saying, what about friends that are happy in your company, never make the effort to contact you? I do all the planning in one of these friendships. It makes me feel a bit used. But I suppose the general thought of that, like, we do have to kind of water the friendships, don't we, and put in the work. And maybe people are busy these days and they don't realise that anymore.
I would say two things. One is that reciprocity is really the key friendship skill in any kind of social relationships with your friends, with your family, etc. Is that we are prepared, when we feel close to people, we're prepared to do them favors, you know, and we don't count the cost, you know, we don't expect immediately that they must do a favor back for us. But over time, we still keep tally, you know, and there's a point where you think, like, this is this seventh time, the 10th time that I have done this, you know, and you know, when am I going to get a bit back from it? And then people have all kinds of strategies. You know, they get cooler with each other for a while. But the other thing is that you may not be good at that particular thing yourself. Like this may not be one of your life skills, you know, picking the right movie to go to, picking the right restaurant, you know, having people over for dinner. But you're good at other things, you know, and they're the things that you can offer to do, something that you're good at, but which they are not very good at.
But make sure you're paying your dues and not just taking. You have to be giving as well.
So if any of my friends are good at tax returns, and letting it be known.
You know what, Maureen Gaffney? People can get all kinds of feel-good kind of waffle on Instagram and all these places now about friendship and soulmatery and all this kind of stuff. It's all about, like, assuming that everyone's nice and that how people should be with each other. The great thing about you is, like, you're old school, like, kind of vicious, like, explaining how people actually are, which I think is way more useful. So thank you very much, clinical psychologist Maureen Gaffney.
Thanks, Brendan. Email brendan@rte.ie.